Our next case is SAP America versus Invest Pick, 2019-13-38. Mr. Evans, when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Best way always to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal is to stop at 10.
Okay. May it please the court. The only thing exceptional about this case is that we're sitting here today with a district court opinion that found this case exceptional and awarded attorney's fees to SAP. This is not a case that was filed by InvestPIC. The only action that InvestPIC took in this case was to send a notice letter to preserve its statutory rights to enforce its patent, and then to oppose a motion for judgment on the pleadings that its patent was invalid under Section 101.
But look, you had a district court to whom we owe deference on an issue like this, and it found, in the words of the Supreme Court, that the case stands out. It referred to previous statement by the PTO that on the merits you're going to lose, very likely. And then the court said that the way you litigated the case in particular, that two people high up in your company engaged in contacts with the other party undercover, so to speak. We owe deference on these findings, don't we?
Yes. On the second set of deference, all that occurred post-final judgment, so I believe that this court has held that under those circumstances, less deference is warranted, but I agree that you do owe deference to those findings. But let's look at the facts that underpin those findings. The problem here is what the district court held is InvestPIC was specifically warned by the USPTO that it looked very unlikely that these claims were directed toward patentable subject matter and very likely that the claims were invalid. That's from Appendix 19. In the district court's order finding the case exceptional. The only fact that underpins that finding is
a footnote
from an appellate brief that this court heard in a case that we won that was coming up from inter-parties and ex-parte reexaminations where 101
court,
was not an issue.
The district court may have overstated what was in that footnote, but I think his point was you were on notice.
But that notice does not overcome the presumption of validity and patentability. Now, this court held very recently in CellSpin v. Fitbit this summer that a patent owner is entitled to both presumption of validity and patentability, and that presumption is not overcome until a defendant has proved the patent invalid. That footnote does not prove the patent invalid, nor does it destroy the presumption of validity. If it did, there would be no presumption of validity, because I can tell you, I have yet to litigate a patent case where I was not told that my patents were invalid under 101, 102, and 103 for sure by a defendant.
The district court in this case did not, though, say, I am not presuming the validity. I thought the district court effectively said the opposite, no?
Well, the district court did cite to Ultramershal and say, typically this creates a presumption of validity of the claims of a patent, but that is not necessarily the case in a court's review of the 101 issue. And then pays a little bit of lip, that's from Appendix 18, and then pays a little bit of lip service to say that this is not necessarily the case. But then he says, because you were warned by the USPTO, you're in essence not...
I'm sorry, but the little bit of lip service, I guess, is what struck me as effectively saying, I will actually presume that it is valid or eligible, and that, in more to the point, InvestPIC had a general right reasonably to rely on the issuance of the patent. So I didn't see anything, I didn't see any problem with what the district court said with respect to burdens. I think there were two things that I guess struck me as about the district court opinion that one is there's no discussion in this opinion about the merits weakness of your eligibility view.
Correct.
And then second, that though the district court found that the conduct of Mr. Miller and Mr. Vanda with respect to dealing with the SAP salesman was, I don't know, stood out. I don't remember a specification of what was wrong with the conduct.
Also correct.
So
can I address both of those points?
Yes.
So while I agree that the district court pays lip service to the burden and appears to put it in the right place, the problem is his application of the burden. He then says that the USPTO warning created a serious cloud on the claims that Investpict had to address before enforcing its patents.
Yeah, but wait a minute. He went on and he said, one of the reasons that the court found this case exceptional was Investpict's unusually weak validity position under 101. The Federal Circuit has affirmed the court's 101 invalidity order. Now, citing to the Federal Circuit can't be all wrong, can it?
No, Your Honor.
No. So maybe he read what we said about it in an earlier opinion by Judge Toronto. He goes on to say, this was first affirmed by a three-judge panel decision. After request for rehearing, the panel issued a substitute order, which again affirmed the court's 101 ruling. And finally, Investpick's request for rehearing en banc was denied. So he took what we did seriously.
That's correct, Your Honor.
It's a little after the fact, I admit that, but nevertheless, why couldn't he rely on what we pointed out was, and I think the language of the earlier opinion suggests it was a pretty weak case.
So, respectfully, the Honorable Judge Toronto did not say that our arguments were weak in his opinion upholding the district court's case, nor did the district court's original opinion on 101 make any comment on the substantive strength of Investpick's arguments. The language you were reading about the unusually weak validity position came several years after that initial 101 ruling in the order that determined the amount of fees that were to be determined. It wasn't made in the exceptional case finding, nor in the 101 case. And that was after extensive briefing on the fact that he had not ruled on the substantive strength on the briefing in additional briefing by Investpick in the interim. So it appears to be him trying to cover his tracks. But again, absent from that language that you said, there's still no finding on the substantive strength of our arguments or why he believed that they are unusually weak.
But
I mean, there's no citation even to anywhere in his orders.
Right, but why isn't it enough, even if that was a kind of shorthand, a kind of incorporation by reference? Look at my earlier opinion, his earlier opinion, which says, you know, this is about mathematics and contracts.
Sure.
And then look at the Federal Circuit's opinion, same thing, just as a shorthand. I view this as on the spectrum of 101 issues, a pretty easy one. Without elaborating, why would he need to elaborate on that purposes of our now quite discretionary review?
Well, one, how are we supposed to appeal a ruling where we don't know the basis of it? I mean, he doesn't give us really any firm foundation for why he thinks it's exceptionally weak. So it's very difficult to address that because, honestly, I don't know. The only clue he gives me is in his exceptional case-finding order, he points that we should have known that the patent was invalid based on the USPTO's footnote, which I would like to read because I think the language is important since that's what everything hinges on. It says, although neither the examiner nor the board rejected Investpick's claims under 35 U.S.C. 101, the director notes that these claims might fail to qualify as patent-eligible subject matter under case law that is developed after the close of examination in this case.
Counsel, we've read the footnote, and I conceded earlier in the conversation that the district court may have overstated the impact of that footnote. You made your point.
Okay.
We can also read the claim. And we have a large body of case law relating to method claims that don't pass 101 muster.
And respectfully, Your Honor, as the Honorable Judge Plager has pointed out, the idea of what is an abstract patent can barely serve as a rule of law because the cases on it often contradict each other. I mean, I could put 10 patent lawyers in a room, we could look at the same patent, and we could have probably 10 different opinions about it.
Not to disagree with your point, we don't deal with abstract patents. We only deal with claims.
Abstract ideas, yes, Your Honor, sorry.
Let's stick with the claims.
Sure. But what this all comes back to is the district court is saying that because the USPTO told us previously that our patent might be invalid under 101, our presumption, we are no longer entitled to rely on our presumption of validity in a case that we did not file. We are the defendant. All we did was defend the validity of our patent. So if we are going to move the bar on exceptional case to where a patent owner can no longer defend the validity of its patent in a declaratory judgment action, quite frankly, there's going to be no case that's not exceptional. I mean, that is so far beyond where any exceptional case finding has ever been made that I don't think that there would be anything that wouldn't qualify under that
standard. Let me move you to another point that the district court seemed to be concerned about. He was concerned about the fact that the two inventors or owners of this patent went to see SAP and gathered information from them. Now, as I understand it, SAP made the first contact with them.
Correct.
Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And then they just sort of played along without bothering to say, and by the way, we're suing you. A small detail. I'm curious, from your experience, is that a customary kind of thing? If they had come to you, counsel, and said, here's what we're doing, would you have said, good news, keep me informed? Or would you have said, wait, don't do that, that'll get us in trouble? Which way would the bar normally go on something like that?
So, to address your hypothetical, lawyers are cautious people. Out of an abundance of caution, I would probably say, let's not engage in that conduct. But I would look into it. And having done the research, I do not believe that there is anything wrong with that conduct. In fact, there's good public policy reasons to allow you to engage in that type of discovery. I mean, these are not control group employees. These are not people that have any knowledge of the case. These are simply salespeople sending you sales material and quoting you sales prices as they would any other customer. You are entitled to that, all that information in discovery. I can tell you we weren't getting it in discovery, and you often don't in these cases. There are many ethical opinions, and I'm cited in the briefs, where they say that discovery under a pretense is not prohibited. I think it's very notable that Judge Kincaid cited no authority that said this is wrong. He cited no ethical rule that was violated. He cited no rule of civil procedure that was violated. He just apparently didn't like it. Now, that is impossible. That's an impossible standard as a litigant to know that you're going to get attorney's fees awarded against you for conduct that has never before been held to be improper. Now, the purpose of 285 is to give the winning party back the money, they compensatory damages for a case that shouldn't have been brought or for conduct that shouldn't have happened. Two notable things about this. One, there's nothing that holds this conduct was wrong. Kincaid admits that it didn't violate any rules, ethics, or other legal obligations that Dr. Varma and Mr. Miller had. Two, and probably most notably, this issue didn't come up in the case. The materials they received were not used in the case. There was not a single filing in this case about it. SAP's lawyers spent no time on this issue during the case. So what is there to compensate for? Nothing. As far as this case is concerned, that conduct didn't even happen. The only time it came up is when SAP filed its motion to get attorney's fees to try to drum up sympathy from the judge by trying to paint us as bad actors. And it worked. And respectfully, I have only 2 minutes left that I would like to reserve some time.
Are you suggesting that we should issue a precedential opinion saying that that kind of conduct shocks the conscience of the court? Would that be useful for future behavior?
Not for me, Your Honor. I would very much hope that you do not issue that opinion. I'm asking for the opposite.
Oh, okay.
But I would say that I do believe there should be some concept of notice that what you are doing is wrong before you get hit with an attorney's fee award of multiple hundreds or millions of dollars. It shouldn't be a guessing game of what conduct is acceptable and what conduct is not. And here we had no notice that the conduct that we were accused of being exceptional was something that could warrant an exceptional case finding.
Counsel, we'll save 2 minutes for rebuttal for you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Vidal.
Morning. Thank you, Your Honor. Morning. May it please the court, Kathy Vidal on behalf of SAP. Your Honors, in this case, the district court found that Investpic was advancing, and I'll quote, an unusually weak invalidity position under 101. And the first time the district court found that the position was weak was not in the fees motion. It was in the original 101 decision. In that decision, the district court said the claims of the 291 patent are difficult to distinguish from the claims in Fluke and from the Supreme Court's example of a claim that calculated the circumference of a circle. That's at Appendix 452. The court found that the claims were directed to math, as did this court, and that math is per se not patent eligible, and that the claims, quote, do not contain any substantial limitations besides those that restrict the abstract idea at issue, end quote. That's at Appendix 451. As to this court's opinion, this court readily found that the claims were directed to, quote, mathematical calculations. That's at this court's opinion, 898 F3rd at 1163, and that they have no plausibly alleged innovation in the non-abstract application realm. Same site. This court held that we readily conclude that there is nothing in the claims sufficient to remove them from the class of subject matter ineligible for patenting and transform them into an eligible application. The law on 101 could not have been clearer in this case, and the district court did not err in finding that the claims were unusually weak. Now, InvestPIC cites to a number of opinions by courts, by judges on this court, where they express some concern about the law around what is and is not an abstract idea. And in fact, in Mayo v. Athena, 12 of this court's judges expressed opinions on their concerns about what falls inside or outside of abstract ideas. In none of those opinions does any judge take the position that mathematics is in question.
Of course, Athena dealt with a different kind of invention.
It did. And as did the other opinion cited in InvestPIC's brief. And yes, there are concerns generally that the meets and bounds of abstract idea is not fully resolved, but there's no case that says that mathematics is potentially not an abstract idea. In fact, the cases say to the contrary. And on this, I would find Inventor Holdings instructive. In Inventor Holdings, the patentee made the very same point. The patentee, before this court in Inventor Holdings, took the position that the law around abstract idea was too uncertain to award attorney fees. And in that case, the Federal Circuit held that while it is sometimes difficult, and quote, sometimes difficult to analyze patent eligibility under the framework prescribed by the Supreme Court in Mayo, end quote, the invention in issue, quote, does not require us to engage in a difficult line-drawing exercise for a claimed invention resting on or anywhere near the margins of patent eligibility. That's at Inventor Holdings at 1379. The same holds true here, that there's nothing that about mathematics that brings it close to that line as to what is and is not patent eligible. And in fact, for the same reasons that this court upheld the district court's finding of exceptional case in Inventor Holdings, the court should do so here just based on the weakness of the 101 argument.
Can I ask you this? As I remember it, the district court here did not say that the weakness of the eligibility position was itself a sufficient reason to award fees. The district court, I thought, pretty conspicuously said these two things together, the second thing being discovery-related conduct that the district court said stands out. Suppose, hypothetically, and then I do want to discuss the discovery point, suppose that I thought that the discovery piece of the district court's ruling was insufficiently supported. Could we affirm anyway? Should we affirm? Or are we obliged to say the district court never said, I would exercise my discretion to find this exceptional on the 101 weakness alone?
In the district court's opinion, the district court addressed both prongs of octane fitness separately. And if you look at Appendix 11, the court held the exceptional case finding was based on the fact that this case stands out for the other in both InvestPIC's litigation position and the manner in which InvestPIC litigated the case. The court went on to say, generally, InvestPIC's weak 35 U.S.C. 101 subject matter eligibility position its notice from the USPTO on this issue, and InvestPIC's opportunity to address this issue made InvestPIC's litigation position stand out. One prong of Octane Fitness. The court went on to say, as to InvestPIC's manner of litigating the case, the court found generally that the case stands out from others in relation to some pretense self-help discovery conducted by key people at InvestPIC. So the court made clear that Octane Fitness has two prongs, and the court could find a case exceptional under either prong. And in this case, the court found the case exceptional under both prongs.
Can I turn to the other piece now and just ask you, what was wrong with the conduct of Miller and Varma in discussing SAP's products with SAP's salesperson?
So turning to the district court's decision, the district court at Appendix 5 concluded that Lee Miller, who was the operating manager of InvestPIC, and Samir Varma, who was the inventor, and I'm not sure if he was even affiliated with Regulus, pretended to be potential customers of SAP, SAP's product that is...
I think I understand the facts. What's wrong with that?
They acted under pretense in order...
So what? I just want to know, what is the norm, the rule norm, the ethics norm, the statutory norm, the something norm that says don't pretend by going to the store and trying to, buy the other side's product or ask the salesperson about how this works?
Well, certainly, let's step back to pre-litigation conduct. So in pre-litigation, you need to satisfy your Rule 11 analysis. And in that context, you could certainly buy a product and analyze it and try and determine whether there's infringement. And in fact, it's incumbent upon you to do so. When it comes to litigation and you know that a party is represented by counsel, the rules change.
So that's what I'm asking. Where's the rule that says don't do this post-filing? Post-initiation of litigation.
This was post-litigation conduct.
This was post-litigation conduct. Post-litigation, and I will say, and
I'm not sitting here saying I don't think it's wrong, but I'm looking for something that says, how do I know that it's wrong? Maybe it isn't wrong, or maybe it is, but I'm not given any source to look at.
So it would be wrong had the lawyer conducted the conduct directly. As far as the individuals conducting the conduct, I'm not aware of an ethical rule that was violated. Now, there doesn't need to be one under Octane Fitness, but I'm not aware of an ethical rule that was violated. The judge in this case was considering all of the circumstances, which was, even though it was the inventor and the operator who conducted the self-help discovery, that information went directly to the lawyer, who then sent a note over to SAP saying, if you don't settle this case, I'm going to bring these facts before the court. So there was something fishy there. Now, was it a direct violation of a rule?
If it had been the lawyer, what rule would have been directly violated?
There's ethical rules in the state of Texas, or state by state dependent, but there's ethical rules that say that once you're engaged in litigation, if you know the party's represented by counsel, you have to deal with counsel. You can't go around counsel and deal with the party
so you
directly.
You made a point that may be significant, which was after these two gentlemen got through gathering their information, they sent it to their lawyer, and the lawyer then used it in an attempt to... influence the party on the other side. At that point, they're using that information, their lawyer is using that information. Does that change the fact, the situation?
It's additional facts the district court could rely on to say this case stands out from the others. Whether or not it reaches the level of an ethical breach, that's not clear, but the court does not need to decide that it reaches that level in order to find this case exceptional under Octane Fitness. And I will say that fact is against the backdrop of earlier communications from InvestPIC counsel to SAP, one of which they threatened millions in attorney fees. And then later they brought these facts to SAP saying, okay, you didn't pay these millions, you're not paying millions in attorney fees, but now we're going to threaten you with discovery that our principals went into your company and gathered. So the district court, in making his ruling on that prong of octane fitness, considered all of the circumstances.
Okay.
And based on the fact that the district court found under both the first prong and the second prong of octane fitness that under either prong this case was an exceptional case, we're asking this court to affirm that decision. And we're asking this court to affirm it as to the full amount of attorney fees that were awarded, because as the district court found, but for the fact that InvestPIC did not heed the PTO's warning, but for the fact that they didn't investigate the very cases the PTO cited, Fluke and Alice, this case would have never been brought and none of these attorney fees would have been accrued.
Well, you're alluding to the fact that the court cut back from the requested fees.
That is correct. The court cut back from the requested fees on a couple different bases. One, they believed that the attorney fee rates could be lower, and so they certainly cut those.
You vigorously contested that.
What is that?
You vigorously contested that.
We did, Your Honor. That was one basis, and the other basis was there was certainly activity that SAP was considering in the patent office, and they cut that as well. So if you look at the ultimate award, it was a fraction of what SAP was asking for in the first instance.
If I remember right, he reduced the lawyers by about 35%.
About 35% for the partners, less for the associates, because apparently lawyers in Texas charge less money.
One was for a PTO filing that was never made. That's correct. You can't really argue against that.
And, Your Honor, we are not. We are not asking for additional attorney fees. We're just asking this court uphold the finding of the district court.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Evans has a couple of minutes.
Sure. I just have a couple quick points. One, I have to respectfully disagree with counsel's statement that if I had contacted the SAP salesman, that would be an ethical violation. The rules in Texas and most states is it's a control group test. So when you represent a corporation, you don't represent every employee in that corporation. You don't represent the salespeople who have no involvement. You represent executives and maybe the general counsel, the control group that's controlling the litigation. And this is a common mistake that defense counsel makes when they say, you cannot contact anyone at my company without contacting me. That is not the law, and that is not true. And that is what SAP has sat here and told you. I am allowed to contact low-level employees who are not involved in litigation when I am litigating against companies. They are not represented by counsel unless counsel has gone to each of them individually and they have hired that counsel as their attorney. Otherwise, they are just people who are not involved in the litigation, third-party witnesses who might have information about the facts that everyone is entitled to talk to. So I disagree strongly that if I had done the conduct that Mr. Lee and Mr. Varma did, that it would be an ethical violation, because it would not be under any state standard that I'm aware of, and for sure Texas's. And we have an ethical opinion to that effect that was submitted by Linda Ease in this case.
You're arguing, I take it, that the district judge's sensitivities to these matters was excessive?
Yes, Your Honor. Agreed. That is exactly what we're saying.
What about the fact that the information was used by the company lawyer to try to get SAP to collapse?
So there's a lot of emphasis on an email that's sent in the heat of a pretty heavily contested litigation. Lots of things get said. Both parties claim they're going to win. Both parties make statement about evidence. Both parties say they're going to win on summary judgment. Both parties always say they're going to get attorney's fees once they prove how very wrong you are. That is just patent litigation. It's bare-knuckle barroom brawls. It's no holds barred. There was nothing attached to that email. That information that Mr. Lee and Mr. Varma used was never brought to the district court, nor was it ever sent to SAP. And to say that we went into the company to get it, I mean, come on. There was conference calls that were held, and there was emails that were sent by SAP salesmen attaching PowerPoint presentations that should be publicly available that they send to every single customer that they're trying to recruit.
Maybe the district court was quietly trying to elevate the behavior of the bar in Texas, do you think?
Well, if he was doing that, he should have been explicit about it. And it's not really for the Supreme Court of Texas to do, not district judge Ed Kincaid. Now, their ethical rules are in place and promulgated by the Supreme Court of Texas, not by district court judges. So if that is to be the rule, that would have to come from them. And I don't think it's enough for an exceptional case to be found because a judge just didn't like what you did. There needs to be a reason behind it. Like, if it is just subjective judicial opinion that your behavior was wrong, and that can elevate a case to an exceptional case, then there is no guidance to litigants to ever know when they will be subjected to attorney's fees, which is a substantial punitive damage. And I don't think that is what the purpose of 285 is. I don't think that's what the law on 285 is. And I think that would be terrible policy. And I'm over, Your Honor. So
thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.
All rise.